Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome, welcome. What a day. I did not think I was going to get here this morning. Being one of those mornings, and the traffic, as you all know, is just dreadful this morning. But we've got three great guests for you to forget all of that. Three very different people with three very different journeys to share. My second guest today is Lucia Greenhouse, whose coming-of-age memoir records her heart-wrenching escape from Christian Science following her mother's illness. Blew apart her family, and the Library Journal writes that through Lucia's memoir, we see how even those closest to us can remain a mystery. Interesting read. And we'll end today's show with Dr. Terry Thomas, whose journey as a widow, theology professor, and Lutheran minister helped him led to him questioning his faith and redefining spirituality on his own terms. And in doing so, he raises and responds to the question, are Seattleites ungodly? But first, let me welcome Mitchell Maxwell to the show. Mitchell Maxwell is an accomplished producer, a director, and 35-year veteran of the entertainment industry. He's known for his ability to spot the next theatrical innovation. He's the visionary producer behind the percussive stomp, the rollicking Broadway revival of Damn Yankees, featuring Jerry Lewis, and received multiple Tony Awards throughout his career, nominations and the Pulitzer Prize-winning drama Dinner with Friends. He has produced also the Broadway musicals Play On, Bells Are Ringing, again, Tony-nominated for Best Revival of a Musical, and Blues in the Night, Tony-nominated as Best Musical, and many more. I could go on for about half an hour here. But all in all, Maxwell's productions have honored, he's been honored with nominations for 10 Tony Awards, 6 Olivier Awards, 15 Outer Critics Circle Awards, 9 Drama Desk Awards, and 3 Obie Awards. And he's won in each category. Mitchell Maxwell, welcome to the show today.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you for having me. I had no idea I did all that.
And you just thought you were going to work, right?
Yeah, I'm going to call my mother and tell her how proud of me she should be.
Well, I should also say you've just had a little shift in direction here. You know, you've been in the industry for 35 years. Many people would now be looking to retire and put up their feet and smoke a cigar and think of all their accomplishments, but you decided to write a novel. It's called Little Did I Know. So let's begin there, Mitchell. Why write a novel now?
Well, I think I chose to write it at this time because I think that working in show business or any business, you know, everybody thinks that show business is so unique to itself, and it is in some ways, but it's still a business with people who have egos and problems and families and issues, just like everybody does. And I think that over the last couple of years, with the world sort of falling apart economically and people losing their self-esteem because their net worth dropped. And, you know, we have to remember that our self-worth is not based on our net worth, and people just having a sense of loss and a loss of faith in community and themselves and so forth, and the world sort of being pulled out from under us. I felt the same way. I mean, I think we all did. I wanted to recapture the joy of the life that we all start with when we're 20 years old and we feel bulletproof and we feel that anything is possible, and we have the courage or the lack of knowledge or I guess the naivete to say, you know, I can do that. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to revisit what got me started in the entertainment business, which happened 35 years ago, and it was a unique and wonderful story with wonderful characters and wonderful adventures, and it turned into It started as just an idea, and then as I guess all novels take shape. I mean, they say in plays, they say when you produce a play, that the only people in the theater who don't know how the play is going to end are the characters, because by the time the audience arrives, they read a review or they spoke to a friend and sort of they know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And as I began this novel, which is really a coming-of-age story of my first 100 days in show business when I was 21 years old, it sort of found its voice and it's found its place. And it turned into a very inspirational book for young people. It turned into a book for my generation of people to remember what it was like to be young, and also to realize that we're still young, and there are lots of second chances and third chances and fourth chances. So what inspired me to write the book was sort of to recapture joy, to recapture the magic of your first kiss, or, you know, the first moment you got goosebumps in the theater, or the first time you fell in love, or any of those things. You know, one of the things that the book says is a line in the book somewhere that says that one of the things that youth does is it creates memories, because it allows you to live a part of your life that turns into memories as you get older. And those memories sort of inspire you to move forward when you're faced with difficulty in your life as you grow up. And so I wanted to write something joyous. I wanted to write something Capra-esque. And I wanted to write something that people would feel good about reading and would put down when they were finished and say and kiss their husband or their wife or hug their child and pick up a new idea and a new vision and just feel good. So that sort of inspired me to do it, and I had a fabulous time writing it, and I have had a wonderful response to it in terms of my goals in writing it, and I'm really proud of it and very happy that I did it.
Yeah, I would say it's a very nice book. Sam August is your protagonist in that, as you said, based on you. How much of you is actually him in the book?
Well, all of him is me. It's written as a novel because I wanted to take certain liberties in terms of being able to make it more theatrical. I didn't want it to... you know, although they say life imitates art or art imitates life, I wanted some leeway in telling the story, my story, through the voice of a fictional character. And I wanted the ability to condense things and make them more interesting and more exciting, which I couldn't have done if it was an actual memoir. Although everything in the book happened. It's hard to believe that it all happened when I look back at it, or friends of mine read it now, but everything did happen, and it's worked for me. I mean, it's worked for me as reading it. I have to say, and I don't want to sound like, I don't know, some strange freakoid, but every time I read the book, I get very, very emotional, because I find that I remember these things, and I remember the people that I was involved with, and just the absolute unabandoned, unbridled passion that these 50 kids who worked with me in 1976, how they brought themselves full bore, you know, with no reservation to make this stuff happen.
Right. And, I think you touched on it earlier when you said we're full of naivete at that age, and it's such a wonderful gift in many ways. I want to talk a little bit, Mitchell, about how you got in theater in the first place. What was it that drove you to take a career path that way?
Well, there's a line in the book that says that youth doesn't come with a roadmap, and I don't really think that life comes with a roadmap. I think that you have to get up and you have to sort of push the rock up the hill and hope that it doesn't roll over you and crush you as you push it up the hill. I think that sort of creating anything in life, particularly in the arts, is a sort of a Sisyphean task. I actually had a change in life. I was And again, it's part of the story of the book. I was actually a fairly sought after young athlete out of high school, and was recruited by many colleges to play football. And then I was in a car accident, and I was unable to play football, and I had no way to go to college. I had no money, and I came up with an idea to sell shows, musicals, which I always had loved, to summer camps, and bring a little bus load of my peers, and we would travel with this in this van with set scenery and costumes, and we'd sleep on the rec room floor of these camps, and we'd put on these shows, and I made some money, and I used that sort of creative thing that I had put together at 18 years old, and I talked my way into college on a semi-scholarship, and I went to Tufts University, and I just have always loved the musical theater. I love all the songs. I love the passion behind it. I love the intellect. I love the fact that you can tell stories that are bigger than life, and I worked very hard in school, not doing anything but really theater and chasing girls. And then when I finished school, it's sort of like we didn't want it to end. None of my friends and I wanted it to end. So that's what led to the book. I discovered an opportunity to rent the oldest barn theater in America, which happened to be in Plymouth, Massachusetts, where the Pilgrims had landed. And I rented it, and we put on shows, and we grew up, and we fell in love, and we fell out of love, and we lost in our innocence, and we had triumphs, and we had disappointments. And that's really what the book is all about, mm-hmm. is the first 100 days of how I got started. And I realized there's a part in the book in which somebody said, one character says to Sam August, you know, why are you doing this? And he says, just to see if I'm good enough to get anybody's attention. And I got a lot of attention, and I went to New York, and I built a fairly substantial career. But I think that what got me started in the theater was my father always said, if you want to make money in life, you have to follow your heart, and money will follow. And Sam August says, and the book says, that, you know, the tagline that we've been using is it's a story that proves the only option in pursuing a life of meaning and consequence is to follow your heart.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. And it's worked out pretty well.
I would say it's worked out pretty well. You actually believe that success is a poor goal for an artist. Tell us a little bit about that, Mitchell.
I'm sorry, success is what?
Success is a poor goal for an artist. That we shouldn't have just success at the forefront of any goal as an artist.
Well, what I've learned about working in the arts for 35 years and working with lots of, you know, quote-unquote successful people, famous people, and I actually did a musical a few years ago, which unfortunately was not successful, but it dealt with sort of the myth of Icarus. And, you know, Icarus wanted to soar, and he flew too close to the sun on wings made of wax, and the wings melted, and he crashed and burned. And I think that there's a question in the arts of what is success. I've always found that. What is success? I mean, is success being famous, or is success doing good work that perhaps only a few people see? Is it good, and no disrespect to anybody's work, I wish I had produced it. I mean, Mamma Mia is a gigantic success.
Mm-hmm.
Gigantic. I mean, it's one of the greatest successes in the history of the theater. I never would have produced Mamma Mia. It wouldn't be in my lexicon of what I wanted to chase or what I wanted to do as a producer. So success is defined by, you know, how it makes you feel. I don't think it's defined by money or fame. I think it's defined by whether or not you as an artist, you who have something to say, achieve those goals. And if millions of people hear what you have to say and embrace it, then you're a successful rich artist. And if only a few people embrace it, then you're still a good artist. I mean, there's always there's been an expression for years that says, if you want to be an actor, then you're an actor. You're either a good actor or you're a bad actor. You're either employed or unemployed, mm-hmm. but you're an actor. Mm-hmm. So you can't aspire to be sort of an artist. You are an artist. You're either good or bad. You're either embraced or rejected. You're either prolific or you're stilted, but you are that. You can't aspire to it, because I think it creates inertia. And I think that one of the great things that I'm proud about in my book is that it talks about, in a wonderfully entertaining way, that the way to be something, the way to do something, the way to become someone is to do it. Is not to talk about it, is to do it. I recently heard one of the graduation speeches in May, quotes from some of the keynote speakers at graduation, college graduations, and David Friedman said, if you want to make a difference in the world, get your face out of Facebook and get in somebody's face.
Oh, God, so true.
So true. If you want to make a difference, get your face out of Facebook and get in somebody's face. And I think that if you want to do anything in life, and, you know, again, we started with this conversation that all businesses are the same. Everything in life that matters, whether it's your children or your wife or your job, in order to find meaning in it, it has to be imbued with passion.
Yeah,
and if you have passion, and an artist must have passion because the rejection is too severe, then you're going to make a difference, and you're going to find some sort of comfort and some drive, and you're going to wake up in the morning and you're going to put your pants on. You're going to say, I'm going to do this today, and you're going to take a step toward doing it. I mean, there's a part of the book which people can't believe actually happened, but I was 21 years old, and I had to raise $32,000 in 72 hours or lose the whole deal. And $32,000 in 1976 for a kid with no money was a lot of money. So I got on the phone, and it's in the book, and I got on the phone and with a roll of dimes and a pay phone, and I made hundreds of phone calls, and I raised $100 here and $50 there. And I called people I hadn't talked to in years. And then I ended up with a pretty good amount of money, but I was still way off. And I decided to call this guy that I knew whose daughter had gone to college with me. And I called him, and I set up a meeting, told him what I wanted, drove to his office in Boston. And he gave me 10 minutes. He was a very powerful lawyer. And he said, you know, I wish you well. I want to help. Here's the best I can do. I'm sorry, son. I hope it's. I wish I could do more. And I got in the elevator of his building, and he had given me a check for $10,000.
Wow!
And those sort of things in life, when you try, and you talk, and you believe, they happen. You know, and I think that
put yourself out there is what it's all about. You know, Mitchell, we've only got a couple of minutes left, and I mentioned at the top of the hour just how many accolades and awards you've won. I mean, it's phenomenal. But like any artist, you put yourself out there and you also have your fair share of critics. Part of our show, of course, is about living well, living strong. And, you know, to live well and live strong, you have to overcome a certain amount of rejection and criticism. How have you managed to bounce back emotionally from bad reviews or bad pieces that have been written about your work?
Well, first, I stay in the fetal position for about a month. No, but that's a very interesting question, and it's been very much of a demon over 35 years. I think the thing that I've come to realize, and I think anybody who aspires to work in a business where people can reject you or comment on you, is simply this: is who are they, and do they really matter, and who are they? Are they smarter than you? Are they better than you? I have a stepson, and he's always calling me. He's 22. He's always calling me for advice about dates. And I say to him, do you like the girl? And if he says no, then I say, why do you care if she likes you? So just because somebody says they didn't like my show or they think that I'm a crazy person because I lost my temper or I believed in something so strongly that I closed the show because I didn't want it to look a different way,
mm-hmm.
doesn't mean that I'm right or wrong. It just means that's what I feel. And I think that I've learned to deal with criticism and negative energy sometimes because you have to. You have to simply to get through it all. Like when you have the flu, you know you're not going to have the flu forever. So you get through it and you feel better and you get up and you do it again and the next one will be better or the one after that will be better and
just keep moving forward.
That's the only way to do it.
Yeah.
Actually, there's a line in the book. I'll let you go. There's a line in the book in which one of the characters asks Sam August, "Don't you want people to like you?"
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "Of course I do, but I'm not going to change who I am so they do, because then they'll be liking somebody who really doesn't exist."
And it sounds to me like that's how you've really lived your life. And great read. It's a great read. And I appreciate you being with us today. Yeah.
Well, thank you for having me. And my website is mitchellmaxwell.com. People can go on and read excerpts of the book. They can order the book. They can write notices to me. And it's a wonderful experience to have written a book and reach the public and talk to people like you. And I really appreciate reaching your audience today and hope it's just the beginning of some, you know, fantastical relationship that evolves out of this 20-minute chat.
There we go. We look forward to more. And again, you can find more about Mitchell at mitchellmaxwell.com. His book, great read, Little Did I Know. Please stay with us. When we come back, we'll be joined by Lucia Greenhouse. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
Hi, this is Julie Forbes. Join me on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 3 p.m. for the Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. Listen to discussions on dog-related topics and call in to voice your opinion or ask my opinion about your dog. We will talk about everything from dog behavior to pet food to dog training programs in prisons. The Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. I'm your host, Julie Forbes. Tune in Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. on Alternative Talk 1150.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
1150kknw.com. It's why they invented the internet. We think Alternative Talk 1150 a.m.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And in this segment, we are going to be talking with Lucia Greenhouse. She's the author of Father, Mother, God. Lucia's a graduate of the Emma Willard School and Brown University. She lives with her husband and four children in New York and is joining us today to talk about her first book. Lucia, welcome.
Thank you.
Interesting read, this. And you got a lot of very great write-ups about it. Some said it's difficult to read, but it's an important book. It's worthwhile. Kirker's reviews said the book is wrenchingly courageous. And then I have a whole bunch of reviews here that I kind of paraphrased. again calling it heart-wrenching, riveting, powerfully affecting memoir, exposing religious hucksterism, exposing monstrous feats of neglect fostered by this strange American manifestation of religious fanaticism, a reminder of how nefarious religious zealotry can be. And we are, of course, talking about Christian Science. Your book is called Father, Mother, God, My Journey Out of Christian Science. So let's begin, Lucia, with your childhood, because you were raised in a Christian Science family. You never knew anything but Christian Science, correct?
That's correct. From my earliest memory, I was a Christian Scientist, which meant that we did not go to doctors. We did not have any medicine in the medicine cabinet. And when we became sick or injured, my parents would call a Christian Science practitioner instead of taking us to a doctor.
And so your first doubts of this began when?
Well, you know, I'm not sure that there was one moment. I think in part my doubt stemmed from the fact that my immediate family was Christian Scientists, but my extended family was not. My parents both converted to the faith when my younger brother was a toddler. So while we were devout Christian Scientists, we were surrounded by more mainstream thinking. You know, the other thing is during the school week and every day, I would be learning things about the real world that were in a complete contradiction to what I was learning at Sunday school. And so I had to try to balance the two. And I guess I really kind of, I believed more in what I was learning Monday through Friday than what I was learning on Sunday.
Interesting. Your mother eventually becomes ill. And you mentioned at the beginning, the Christian Science don't believe in medication. They don't believe in contagion. They don't believe in illness even. Talk to us a little bit about that. I know you had smallpox at one point. Not smallpox.
I know I had chickenpox.
Chickenpox. Yeah, I don't think you'd be here. But yeah, chickenpox.
Right. And chickenpox is actually, it's a very, I think, a good way of explaining how the church doctrine works. I got chickenpox right after my sister did, and my brother got them at the same time that I did. But Christian Scientists don't believe in contagion, and they don't believe in illness. They believe that sickness is the outward manifestation of incorrect thinking, so that when I woke up with spots on my hands and arms, I was told that those spots were an illusion, much the same way that a mirage is the appearance of water on the edge of the desert where there's nothing but water. I mean, I'm sorry, nothing but sand.
Mm-hmm.
And so you know, that kind of made sense to me, and I thought, well, you know, I suppose if the visual evidence is an illusion, maybe the itching is too. And I prayed using the Christian Science prayers, and we sang hymns, and we read from the Bible and the Christian Science textbook, Science and Health. And after a few days, my spots crusted over, and I believed that I had done a pretty good job as a Christian Scientist.
Interesting. I found this fascinating because I knew nothing about Christian Science until I read this. I read one article, which was written several years ago, but they called it the respectable cult, a cult that's faced many of the accusations that such as Scientology and other groups that have been named cults face, but they've come out of it somehow respectable.
Yes, and I've been reluctant to use that word, in part because I would like to reach some people who may still be somewhere on the spectrum of faith in Christian Science, and if I used incendiary words like that, I will just turn them off, and I really want to get my message out there. But there certainly are some very controlling aspects of the church. And in my family's case, the secrecy and this concept of mental malpractice literally destroyed my family. And just to explain, mental malpractice is a concept in Christian Science, which the idea is that one person's negative thoughts or incorrect thinking can adversely affect another person's health, which means that if Christian Scientists are very guarded when they become sick or injured. The first thing they try to do is establish an environment that's conducive to Christian Science healing, which means effectively shutting out any outside influences.
It's quite fascinating, this. It's called, and again, it's called mental malpractice, and that caused you a great deal of guilt as you were growing up, because when your mother got ill, you felt you were made to feel guilty about this, about your feelings and your thoughts and your questioning.
You know, what it did was it put us in a terrible bind, because when my mother became sick, my sister and brother and I were young adults, and we had each disavowed the faith. So we were viewed with suspicion from the moment we discovered that our mother was sick. In fact, we were never told she was sick. We came home Christmas Eve in 1985 and discovered that she was sick and probably had been for some time. And because of this notion of mental malpractice, and because we'd been raised in the faith, we understood immediately that we were facing our worst nightmare, that our mother would never likely seek medical attention, but we would be expected, out of respect for our parents, to honor my mother's wish that her illness be kept secret.
Mm. You say all through the illness of your mom, your father never compromised his beliefs. He was a very strong believer, whereas you had never fully understood them. That affected your relationship with your father.
It did. Actually, what I said was he never compromised his beliefs, but I never was allowed to fully, act on mine, because I felt like I needed to honor my mother's wish to not be to be left alone to pray her illness away. And so in particular with my mother's family, this was a very, very difficult situation. My mother came from a medical background, and her brother was a surgeon. Her father had been a doctor, and her mother had been a nurse. So my mother ended up in a Christian Science care facility called 10 Acre. She was there for almost 7 months, and during that time, my mother's family never knew that she was sick.
Interesting. How did they react when they found out, Lucia?
Oh, they were understandably livid. They were just distraught. It almost killed my grandmother. They were understandably upset. They took it out on, unfortunately, they took it out on my brother and sister and me, not knowing that we were not Christian Scientists.
Mm-hmm.
And not knowing that we were not just in lockstep with the church. It was an extremely difficult time for everybody.
Yeah. We're almost at the end of our segment, but I know that you anguished for years about, you wrote this loosely years and years ago when you first met your husband. You published this, rewrote it, and published it many, many years later. Why now? Why tell the story now?
Well, you know, I might have done it sooner, except I have four kids, and it
good
took
excuse.
Me this long to do it. But this is a story that I've always felt needed to be told, because Christian Science has a really very positive reputation, more or less, and the Christian Science Monitor is a world-class newspaper, but I think the reputation of the newspaper has allowed the church to hide behind it. And I want people to know what has happened and what continues to happen in the church.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you want to get your message out to people, of all faiths. And you, what final words would you like to leave them with today?
Well, one of the things that people just gasp at when they hear this is that Christian Science care facilities, are many of them get Medicare dollars, and it's really an astounding fact, because these are care facilities where there is absolutely no care. My mother eventually went to a hospital, and by the time we got her there, she was in a pre-morbid state. She'd had months and months of neglect. She arrived in a severely malnourished state, and with just infection coursing through her body and bed sores everywhere. And the idea that this can take place in institutions that get money from Medicare is just astounding to me and to anybody who hears that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I would like to talk to you some more. I'm actually working on a separate series looking at various aspects of religion, and I would definitely like to talk to you some more about this. We've got to go for now, though, unfortunately, Lucia. LuciaGreenhouse.com is where you can find out more information about Lucia. And
that's
her,
right.
And her book, Father, Mother, God, My Journey Out of Christian Science. Lucia, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
And again, luciagreenhouse.com is where you can find out more information. And please do stay with us when we come back. We'll be talking with Terry Thomas about his new book called From Religion to Reality. And he raises the question, are Seattleites ungodly? We'll find out more. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Set it up. That's me in the corner. That's me in the spotlight. Losing my religion. Does it say doormat turn me back? So why'd you treat me like that? It must be the doormat on me back.
If you're sick of one-sided discussions, tired of losing arguments, or can never think of the right thing to say at the right time, tune in to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair on Monday, October 10th. Whether you're a raging bull or worn-out doormat, Robert Mayer shares proven techniques to help you stand up for yourself without raising your voice or rolling over. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific. Follow Vicki on Twitter for program news and upcoming show information at hashtag Vicki St. Clair.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
Do you have legal questions? Need to know where to turn?
Hi, this is Rick Gregrick, your host of Northwest Legal Compass.
Northwest Legal Compass will address your questions on a variety of legal topics, including estate planning, asset protection, real estate and business planning, and more. The legal and accounting staff of Gregrick and Associates are dedicated to providing you with superior legal and tax services. Their integrated counsel is geared to the achievement of your goals.
Visit us on the web at rjglegal.com.
Be sure and tune in every Friday at noon here on Alternative Talk. Talk 1150.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
No shirt, no shoes, no problem. Come as you are. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. We are in our last segment today. We're joined right now in the studio by Terry Thomas. Dr. Terry Thomas. He's the author of At Least We Were Married, and his new book is called Religion to Reality. The first book told his story of love and grief after losing his wife on their honeymoon in a car crash that nearly killed him, too. And this book is an exploration of his own spirituality and his journey. So I'm going to bring you right on, Terry. Welcome, Terry Thomas.
Thank you for having me, Vicki.
And I'm going to let you share your journey in your own words. So we're not talking today about, you know, your first book, but it's integral to how you got here today, the death of your wife and you almost losing your own life, and you started questioning your own faith. Talk to us a little bit about that time, if you would.
Well, the biggest point in this book that I wanted to bring out after reflection for a long time was that at the time of that accident, when I was all smashed up and in pain and numb, and they had put me in a, laid me on a gurney, and I was in the hospital hallway, and they were deciding what to do, and they did not expect me to live. My parents were just at the boarding gate. And they had called, managed to track them down at the airport and said, if you want to see your son alive again, you better get here as quick as you can. They had no idea there was an accident till then. And yet I had kind of like a vision, almost like it was written on the wall. Mm-hmm. It said, you will live, and you have a great purpose for living. And my body just suddenly felt very, very wonderful. you know? And to me, that is such a contradiction to what should have been. And the only thing I can explain is that it was a spiritual experience. And that went on to drive me forward then for the rest of the journey I'm on now.
Mm-hmm. Now, you already were religious, right?
Yes.
And you practiced what faith?
I grew up in the Lutheran faith. And at 3 weeks old, I was first taken to church in a little blanket. And the first thing that started in church was a confession. And I realized now in my reflection how much that was embedded down in my psyche. The confession was, we confess that we are by nature, think about that a minute, by nature sinful and unclean.
Mm-hmm.
I and many, many others and our whole culture really in one form or another have grown up with the idea that our nature is really pretty bad off.
And but, you say that led to feelings of low self-worth, low yes, self-esteem. And I should imagine it would if you're reciting that on a weekly basis.
Exactly. So part of my training was to discover how powerful that that guilt consciousness drove me. And now to the point to see how actually my mission, because I've been able to work through that, and that is not easy. Big part of my book is many, many hurdles I had to overcome where you don't get much help.
Right, right. So after the death of your wife and you know, searching a little, you joined you became involved in Campus Crusade for Christ.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I was a student up at Western Washington, and Campus Crusade was a bunch of young people, dressed nice, sharp people. Ended up we all figured out some things that we didn't approve, that were just not honest about what we were led to do. But they ended up recruiting me, and I went into it. And so I had that experience, far different from the Lutheran, you know, liturgical, mm-hmm. Quiet organ music into more the jumpy, clap-your-hands type religion. And our mission was to go on campuses and convert students to Christ. And I was pretty good at it, actually. And but then after a while, I began questioning, wait a minute. In a 20-minute presentation, there's got to be more to this gospel thing that we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to see it wasn't working for kids. The promises were just exuberant. And now today, I can look and see that these things are still being done through churches. And people keep buying into it, and a lot of guilt is produced and a lot of shame.
Right.
And that's very controlling.
Right. Well, you've been quoted as saying, I've heard many religious leaders call the people of Seattle ungodly because of the low church attendance here. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to have you answer that question. please stay with us. Terry Thomas is my guest. His new book is called Religion to Reality, and you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicki St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicki asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
There's an exciting new Astrology Hour, Tuesdays at 5 p.m. with Deborah Silverman. Deborah's unique blend of psychology and astrology turns planetary language into plain English. Join us for an interactive hour that's guaranteed to give you personal insights in a fun and entertaining way. Tune in to Deborah Silverman Live. Whatever your life question, marriage, job, family, relocation, or just curiosity, call for a live reading Tuesdays at 5 p.m. and visit Deborah's website at DeborahSilvermanAstrology.com.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Join us live every Monday at noon on Alternative Talk 1150 or stream live from conversationslive.net.
Independent programs, independent voices, independent ideas. Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And right here in the studio with me, I have Dr. Terry Thomas. He's spent many years at Marquette University as a theologian professor. He had a 25-year career as a Lutheran minister. And I'm going to ask you this question next, in case we run out of time.
Okay.
Terry, I've heard you say that you've heard many religious leaders call the people of Seattle ungodly because of the low church attendance here. But you've come to believe what?
Well, I was transferred out here, and I began to encounter people who claimed to be spiritual but not religious. And being a philosopher kind of mindset and a theologian, I had to stop and think about that. And I began to see, and now, what's kind of shocking to me is I ran across a fellow from down in Oklahoma, a pastor, and he said his county is the highest churched county in the United States.
Wow.
Whether that can be proven or not, I don't know, but it's mm-hmm. certainly up there. And it's filled, he said, with these towering, you know, fundamentalist-type churches that really lay down the literalism and the fear of the devil and guilt and fear of hell. And I had forgotten people were still afraid of hell, but it's all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And it creates a guilt consciousness and low self-esteem. That's where I'm coming from and my work to help release people from that. And yet he said that his county had a very high social problems, divorce, spousal abuse, child abuse, and a lot of social problems that were just horrific. And it's like, what's the contradiction here? If we're so highly churched, why should we be so full of all this terrible stuff, that way people treat each other? And in my mind, as a theologian, I connect it to the power of guilt that people are fed week by week by week. Because when we have this guilt, I'm not talking about being truly guilty of some behavior.
Right, right.
But a guilt consciousness, it renders us powerless.
Mm-hmm.
We are not able to perform the way on the higher level of our human nature. And so there's a lot of guilt thrown around there. And I get to Seattle and I say, wait, we're supposedly the lowest churched. And yet I don't see this.
That surprises me, because when I first moved here, I couldn't believe how many churches were here.
Yeah, but you go in. I mean, I was a Lutheran pastor, like you said, and I love the Lutheran. I have no problems. Loving the church and its people. I'm just not there.
Mm-hmm.
But you go into them, you know, you get 50 people or 60 people on a weekend or something, and you go to one of the fundamentalist churches, they'll have more in their whole church than the whole Pacific Northwest has
right,
in all
right.
their churches put
right.
together when you do the statistics.
Right. So you just mentioned how many people believe in hell and the devil. You say, based on your research, that kind of teaching creates hypocrisy. Talk to us about that a little.
Hypocrisy. The way it happens is when we have a deep, you know, I'm going into psychology now, which mm-hmm. I've studied depth psychology. When we have a deep feeling of guilt that really drives our life, yet we're told that we need to be good. What we do is we find ways to, and I did this, and my story is about my journey.
Right.
And we find ways to try to look good, or try to at least outwardly, but down deep inside, we know there's something missing. We know we're not true. There's a hypocrisy is simply a disconnection between what we try to be in our outward concept and what we feel we are in our deep inner. And so we try to deny that. We try to ignore it, pretend it doesn't exist.
Right, right.
And cover it up with all kinds of denials and religious things that give right. us denial, and communities and so on.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
I know the bulk of your work now is getting people to try and question traditional religion.
Mm-hmm.
You say most of it's bought, you know, it's based on teachings that are obviously centuries old,
mm-hmm.
and so many people follow blindly without mm-hmm. questioning, and you want people to question this. Why do you think so many people do follow blindly? And is that what blind faith means?
I think, it's like the old story of the little girl that said, Mama, it was Thanksgiving. Why did you cut the tail off the turkey when you put it in the oven? She said, I don't know. I'll ask my mother, ask grandma. She asked her, and she said, finally, the answer came back when they got to the great grandma. Well, the oven was too small.
Right, right.
You've heard that probably many people.
I remember that, yeah.
Once a tradition is embedded in us, we relate, especially in the world of religion, our early memories with other things. And when we begin to break a religious tradition, all those memories get thrown into the hopper. For example, my grandmother was my first Sunday school teacher. Thank goodness she read the Bible every day. And when I got older and was learning a little different way of looking at the Bible, she said, Terry, I read it every day, but I don't know what I'm reading. She was doing it out of duty. And so it was not, it was a little easier for me to break some of that early stuff. I was taught knowing that she was doing her best. She loved me. And it's my responsibility to move forward on behalf of my whole family and religion. And to, I have the opportunity now to reflect. And that's my God-given personality. So I think it's hard to break because traditions have a lot of sentimental emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And many of us do not ever, ever, ever want to touch those because we feel we're throwing grandma out.
Right. And you say being non-conventional is built into your DNA anyway.
Yeah.
You say that in the book.
Okay.
Which is not a bad thing because, I think it's good to question. And as you mentioned in the break, be a student of life.
I've had to come to accept that about myself, and just quit trying to be conventional and just be who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And I love it. And that's what I encourage everybody to be.
Right. I want to talk about your book, Religion to Reality. And you say that it contributes three things to spirituality that some books and teachers may overlook. One of those is forgiveness. One of them is the need for community.
Mm-hmm.
And also that you are always encouraging people to try and find their own path. Just mm-hmm. talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Okay. And by the way, they can get the book on Amazon.com or any of the good bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
I have a few little tweaks on my own website, but if they order it directly from me, they get an autographed copy.
Okay, very good.
What I found, though, in Seattle for my own life is I began to study more and more. I've always kind of had a mystical feeling in my life, but I've been studying spirituality. It was only when I found, I didn't know there were communities, powerful communities that have the same ideas that there's many paths to God. We honor all paths to God, and they take anyone by the hand, wherever they are, on their path, and that's what I teach in my book. Follow your own path, not mine, not anybody else's. Find out where you are.
Mm-hmm.
You may not know where you want to go, but you know it isn't where you're at. You want to move and find your own path. So that's the community aspect. The forgiveness is a powerful, powerful thing. I think many people in spirituality have not been able to, and the reason is because it's a difficult subject. The minute you say, well, we need to forgive, we know Christ taught, if you don't forgive, you're not forgiven. The point is, forgiveness is really releasing someone from control over you. It's associated again with guilt.
Right, right.
And so that's one of the main points I make. I can't cover the whole world of spirituality or anything.
No, of course not. And we have about 30 seconds left. So
sure.
the last point is trying to get people to think for themselves and think outside the box, just as we teach in business,
mm-hmm.
But think outside the box with religion too. What would you like to leave listeners with on that note?
Well, I'd like to leave them with the thought of taking some time to write down what they believe, and really look at it and think about it and begin a journey of moving forward, not just being stuck. I mean, that's part of what my book is about, getting unstuck from stuff. And I know it's hard because,
yeah.
And it's painful sometimes, but it's worth it.
And your living testament.
And
we're right at the end of our segment now, so I want to thank you, Dr. Terry Thomas, for being with us today. Dr. Thomas's new book is called Religion to Reality, and you can find out more about Terry and his work at drterrythomas.com. Dr. Terry Thomas?
Terry C. Thomas.
Okay.
It has a C in the middle, and they won't find the website.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Dr. Terry C. Thomas.
Right.
.com.
Yeah.
All right. You need
right.
to change your website. I got this off your website.
Oh, you did?
All right.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's all good. It's all good.
Because they were still tweaking and maybe there was an error.
Yeah, we'll be back next week. And I hope until then you will live well, live strong. Thanks for being with us.
Does it say doormat on me back? So why'd you treat me like that? It must be the doormat on me back.
If you're sick of one-sided discussions, tired of losing arguments, or can never think of the right thing to say at the right time, tune in to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair on Monday, October 10th. Whether you're a raging bull or worn-out doormat, Robert Mayer shares proven techniques to help you stand up for yourself without raising your voice or rolling over. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific. Follow Vicki on Twitter for program news and upcoming show information at hashtag Vicki St. Clair.